Hello, guys. Welcome to Coffee Talk with Rob and Greg, episode 37. I'm Rob.
Hi, guys. I'm Greg, and welcome again back to another episode. Today, we've got a very special guest called Paul Teasdale, and I've been lucky enough to connect with him before this, and his stories have really blown me away already. So, Paul, hi. I wonder if you could just sort of briefly explain what you're doing now and how you got to the position you're in, and then we can go into a couple of different stories there.
Okay, well, thanks for having me, Rob and Greg, and greetings to everyone listening.
Welcome.
So basically, I'm from Victoria Falls in Zimbabwe. Victoria Falls is home of the largest waterfall on the planet. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful thing. Everyone should see it at some point in their life. And I was lucky enough to live there with it in my backyard. And Zimbabwe, as most people who have heard of Zimbabwe know, it has been under some quite crazy economic downturn over the last 20 years, hyperinflation, general misery and mayhem when it comes to living there. I mean, it's an amazing place to visit, and I would encourage anyone to go there anyway, because from a tourist perspective, there's plenty of facilities from budget all the way through to five-star there. And tourism side of things is the heart and life, the lifeblood of the country. So it's very, very good for tourism, but actually living there and dealing with the day-to-day grind is quite tough. And as a result, I decided that it was my time there was done, and it was time to go to greener pastures where a bit more financial freedom and security could be generated over a longer period, and also truthfully just different life goals to achieve that couldn't be achieved in the environment that I was. And the environment that I did live in, I achieved massive life goals there. But now they're achieved, I need to do bigger things. So I'm now in the UK, the place of my birth, yeah, and the place of my heritage.
Yes.
So it's nice to be home in some ways, but also having spent 34 years of my life in Zimbabwe, it's also new to me being here.
Sure. So you were saying about your heritage. I'm guessing, obviously your family come from England, and they went across to live in Africa, right? Or
yeah, my dad's side of the family, but we're talking about like the 1800s, late 1800s.
Sure.
And I mean, my dad was born in 1927, so he was very old. So his father was born in 1901, and his father's father obviously was born in the 1800s, and they're all Yorkshiremen from Barnsley area.
Oh yeah,
but my dad's father, so my grandfather came to Zimbabwe whenever he did. But my dad's mother's side were German Jews that actually came to Zimbabwe in the 1800s. So from my dad's mom's side, it's a longer Zimbabwean heritage. From my dad's dad's side, it's a slightly shorter side. So there's more British from my dad's dad's side.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, it's funny when we go back and look at our heritage, isn't it? What where it all kind of comes from, because my dad's Italian, but he was born in Bristol. But if I look back at that, and it's probably a lot more that goes into different stuff about it, if you're doing those tests or whatever. Paul and I were lucky enough to chat before this this podcast. And I know Rob, being a fitness guru and coach, expert, webinar, does everything with fat loss and things like that. Paul and I were talking a little bit about the different levels of fitness and things like that that he's been involved with as well, and training and things. I knew that Rob would be interested. But do you want to tell us, Rob, and our audience a little bit about the story you told me? Because I find it thoroughly fascinating.
So basically, the final nail in the coffin for me wanting to leave Zimbabwe was a big downturn where I got evicted from my house because the owner of the house sold the house, and the new owner wanted to turn it into a lodge in Victoria Falls. And Victoria Falls being built in the middle of a national park area, there's no room for expansion, so there's a major housing shortage there, and most of the houses have been converted into Airbnbs or lodges. So when you lose a rental property, to find another one is almost impossible. So I got into a bit of a bad place mentally and as a result physically, and I put on a lot of weight over that period while I was trying to find what the new transition was. And I went from being generally like quite I've always been quite fit and athletic because I've been a professional sportsman most of my adult life. I went to 101 kilograms, so that's 220 pounds. And for someone my height, I'm only 5'9".
Okay.
That's a lot of weight. So yeah, I got into a really, really, really bad headspace. And at the beginning of 2019, I finally decided that I was going to leave, come to the UK and join the paratroopers, join the British Parachute Regiment.
Mm.
And with that goal in mind, I lost 22 kilograms in 12 weeks.
So what was the process you went through in order to kind of lose the weight, but also get fit for, because I'm assuming you would have had to do some sort of fitness test.
Yeah, so exactly. So my goal was to be able to run the 1.5 miles in under 8 minutes, 40 seconds. I've never run in my life. That's one thing I've tried to avoid like the plague. I hate running. Cannot run. But, and then, so basically what I did was, for me, my mental health is directly related to my diet. If I'm eating badly, my mental health deteriorates ridiculously. I get very depressed, very anxious, ratty. I need to not eat sugar. I need to not eat wheat because I'm allergic to wheat. I need to not eat junk, basically.
Yeah.
And so the first thing I did for the first week, I just cleaned up my diet completely.
Yeah.
And got my head in the game. Then also over the period, I started to get I've always had it, but I started to get more of a realization of my relationship with discomfort and suffering, and realized that I'd always pushed my own boundaries and always pushed my comfort zone a lot. But now I put my running into that sort of category where I wanted to push my comfort zone and make myself suffer as much as possible. So the running was a good way to do that, especially starting at that weight. So I started with I mapped out a 1.5 mile run that I started to do daily. And I remember the first day I tried to run it, I got less than halfway and had to walk. And I was just absolutely mortified with how absolutely disgustingly unfit I was. And then the next day I ran again, but I knew where I got up to that day. And I promised myself, because we've got street lamps on our streets, and they're roughly 50 meters apart, I think. Maybe a little less.
Mm.
Roughly 50 feet, 50 yards. I don't know, for the listeners who don't know meters and stuff. But so every day when I ran, I pledged to myself, no, I'll just run to the next lamppost that I had done from yesterday.
Good.
And yeah, it progressed like that. And I basically just started lying to myself while I was running and saying, okay, just to the next one. And when I got to the next one, I'd be like, okay, just to the next one. And then I'd get to the next one. Okay, just to the next one. And before I knew it, I was running the full 1.5 mile loop on a daily, every single morning. And then from a diet perspective, I incorporated a little bit of intermittent fasting, and then massively, I'm a very nerdy scientific type character, so I like metrics. So calorie counting, always, I like to measure all the metrics in what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Calorie deficit is always the key with that. I mean, you can go keto.
Very much agree.
Yeah, you can do whatever fad diet you want. You're not going to get anywhere unless you've got a calorie deficit. But for my mental health and for everything, a keto type diet works really well for me.
I would assume as well, as you said, with being gluten intolerant, that probably helps with cutting out a lot of the stuff that will aggravate that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the problem is when you're gluten intolerant, you know, a lot of the carb-based stuff is going to be, there's a lot of wheat involved. So when you're trying to train hard, you need the energy from the fat. So that's why I subscribe to, like, I keep on saying keto type, because I don't subscribe to keto as a religion.
Yeah.
It's just a guideline,
right,
of how I try to eat. Because I very, very much try to stay away from any kind of fad diet or fad exercise or
I do that with everything. I try to avoid anything that anybody tells me you should do now. I think, why, you know? I'm always questioning, you know, things that I could do it my own way or whatever. And I knew Rob would be interested in this, because you were able to really change your life. And so you went for the army training as well. Did you want to talk a little bit about that.
Okay, so then in the mornings I do that run, and then in the afternoons I have my best mate has a bit of gym equipment at his house, and he's a fitness nut, and he encouraged me to spend the evenings with him. He's always been really good at and disciplined at keeping fit. And the evenings I would go and do with him some kettlebells, rowing, battle ropes, you know, just mix it up on a daily, just trying to expend as much energy as possible. And yeah, I smashed 22 kilograms in the 12 weeks and was ready to go. And nice. During that 12 weeks was when we diverted into the other story of going off to Mozambique and the Eastern Highlands of Zimbabwe for the cyclone stuff.
Yeah, do you want to just whip through that story if you don't mind?
Sure.
It blew my mind anyway.
So I've living in Vic Falls, I've been basically whitewater kayaking on the Zambezi River for the last 7 years or so. And in the process, I've been teaching survival courses, working on film shoots, and designing challenges for reality TV shows, international reality TV shows, and doing safety stuff for them in the wilderness safety backup and all the rest of it. And a lot of my survival course stuff is we have a format where we have three instructors. One normally is a professional hunter guide who takes care of like animals and wilderness stuff, because we're in a big five area. There's lions, elephants, all the rest of it. Then we have someone who's normally ex-military just for the brand. And then we have someone like me whose speciality is remote logistics, remote access and terrain crossing and stuff like that. So rivers, mountains, etc. So I have a lot of I shipped it to the UK with me. I have a lot of rope access gear, you know, carabiners, harnesses, ropes, pulleys, rescue gear, you name it. And I didn't ship my kayaks over, but I back home I have five kayaks and stand up paddle boards and all nice. Sorts of equipment and experience in those areas. So there was a massive cyclone that hit Mozambique and the Eastern Highlands of Zimbabwe last year in March. It was called Cyclone Idai. You can Google it. It was quite devastating. I can't remember if I might be lying, but I think it was the largest cyclone to hit the Southern Hemisphere in history or something like that. I don't know. But anyway, it created massive, massive devastation. There was big problems and lots of people unfortunately lost their lives. But while it was going on, I put a post on Facebook and basically just said, I have skills, I have equipment. If you get me to the Eastern Highlands, I will do what I can to help. So I put it out to the people. And the reason I did that was because Zimbabwe's resources in that area are extremely, extremely limited. And within an hour, there was a lorry parked outside my house and it was loading up all my equipment and me and ferrying me across the country, roughly 900 to 1,000 kilometers across the country to go and help with the situation. And along the way there, the owner and CEO, he's probably the biggest businessman in Zimbabwe, if not Africa. He owns the largest mobile network provider in Africa. His name is Strive Masiwa. He got wind of what I was trying to achieve and got his people to contact me and say that they wanted to adopt me under their wing and facilitate my rescue attempts in the Eastern Highlands. So that was very important because, you know, when I arrived there, there was the military had set up camp and there was a couple of NGOs, doctor NGO organizations like MSF, but there was nobody in the rescue type field. So, and arriving there as in Africa, especially as a solo white boy, you just get laughed off the field. You know, they're like, who the hell are you, mate? what are you doing here?
Come on, get out of here.
So luckily I was moving with the chief of staff from the mobile network provider, two of his managers and his personal assistant, with the weight of the CEO behind him. And they introduced me to the military generals who, you know, and they said, this is who we are. This is our guy that we've adopted as our rescue consultant. And we'd like to work with you and our bosses told him to do an evaluation of the situation, and according to his evaluation, we'll start throwing funds at the rescue ops. So they immediately provided a military helicopter and pilots, and I went off on a recce with them and evaluated the situation and got back to the big man with what I saw. And he mobilized, in the end, 8 helicopters, 1 personally for me to use. And I spent the next 5 days working from like 5 a.m. in the morning until 1 a.m. again at night, pulling people out of rivers, mountains, evacuating people in choppers, getting aid out to the villages, just full on going, trying to rescue and help as many people in that situation as possible.
And obviously some of these people, they'd passed away, and that must have been quite traumatic to deal with at the time. How did you find you coped with it?
So I've dealt with traumatic experiences like that a bit in my life. I mean, nothing on that kind of scale. I've done a couple of body retrievals, both scuba diving and river stuff, and various other random situations that have been quite gory. Yeah. But I mean, I've never seen that many unfortunate deceased people in my life. We had to load up that many into helicopters and get them out, and wow. It was quite serious. And the thing is, during the day, while you're doing the work, it's just a case of getting on with it. You're too busy, too focused, too driven. This is the other thing, because like everybody thinks I'm some kind of brave kind of character because I hang off cliffs and all the rest of it and hang from helicopters with ropes. I'm really not. I'm quite a wuss, to be fair.
You can't make sure.
I was the scared kid in school. I was never any kind of big brave, I wasn't the brave one. I was the very average kid. Uh-huh. And the thing is, when you get into those situations where life requires from you more,
right,
you just do it because you're so busy doing what needs to be doing that you forget to be afraid, you forget to be put off, you forget to be grossed out by what you're seeing, and you just do what needs to be done because it's more important that you get what's done than your own sort of emotions at the time. You have to just set it aside. And it's another thing, they always, when you do any kind of rescue training, they always talk about how you have to ensure your own safety first. It's because you get into that mindset of you will do whatever it takes to save the life that you often forget about your own safety. So it's very important. And that's the best way I can relate to you, how you just forget about it. But then by the end of the night, I mean, I think I cried myself to sleep a couple of nights, but I think as long as you process the emotion, go through it, allow it to flow instead of bottling it all up and trying to ignore it, then you see some crazy shit, you see some scary things, you acknowledge it and let it flow and move on. Mm.
So you it's a few interesting points there, and I think Rob would agree that it's like the processes you went through there were sort of new to you in some ways, and I suppose it partly builds your character in some ways and helps you grow and then deal with different life scenarios with a new approach or perspective, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was also an interesting thing because, again, like I'd also got to that depressed place in my life because I had put happiness above growth. Whereas it was weird because I had always had a growth mindset before. But then getting into a rut and a routine and a this and then almost getting to a point where my lifestyle was almost like I felt entitled to it rather than I should be working for it.
Right.
I got to that point of entitlement where I had got into a fixed state, and then shifting myself out of that to get fit again and all the rest of it, put myself back into that growth mindset and back into that thing of that relationship with discomfort. So whilst you're going through that, if you manage to keep in the forefront of your mind that this is growth, what you're experiencing, although it feels negative now, it's growth, and the net result will be positive while you can get through anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's an important point a lot of people don't really talk about always. And you might hear about it on the podcast or book or whatever, but it's an important point to make, I think, that is that, yeah, we're going to be in life, all of us, uncomfortable at times, have challenges, even fail and you know, fall down. And we just got to get back up stronger. And sometimes in your situation, you were forced to focus at the job in hand. So it kind of, brought out a part of you which you may have not experienced before. And what happened in the, if you'd like to just touch about the river as well, that you told me about the situation you were in when you, and you went in, and it was quite hectic.
Okay, so from the Zimbabwean side, most of the stuff I did on the Zimbabwean side of the border was high-angle, mountainous helicopter stuff. And then when I went, after I'd finished all the evacs and rescues that I could do in Zimbabwe, I put another post on Facebook saying, because Mozambique was more hard-hit than Zimbabwe, I said, look, if people need me in Mozambique, just say so and get me there, and I'll do whatever I can there as well. So a remote farming community in Mozambique got hold of that Facebook post and requested me to come. So I put out the thing saying, get me there. And then another mate of mine, who is an all-around legend, and basically he's the guy I want to be when I grow up, he contacted me and said, listen, I'll pack my truck tonight, pack my car tonight, and I'll pick you up tomorrow morning, and we'll cross over into Mozambique and to the thing, and we'll work together, him and I, and do whatever we can. And when we got there, it wasn't so much rescues that were required, but more remote aid logistics, because the river, the Lusitê River that we were operating around, had swelled so much and broken its banks and broken all the rivers. There was no way for communities on the other side of the river to cross over for healthcare or for aid or any sort of rescue to go to them to know if they were stranded or to even know who was there. So they needed some people that could navigate dangerous river because it's in flood. And when I showed them my kayak that I was going to use to cross this river and navigate the river, the community there said, are you seriously getting in the water with that thing? I was like, yeah, what's the problem? They said, buddy, there's crocodiles here that frequently eat villages, massive crocodiles, and it's packed full of crocodiles, and there's a lot of hippos. And if anyone knows anything about hippos, hippos kill more people than any other animal in Africa, besides mosquitoes. And I was like, yeah, okay, on the crocodile side, don't worry, I got this, because I kayak on the Zambezi frequently, and there's plenty of crocodiles there as well. And also I've been doing rescue relocation of reptiles pretty much my whole life. So I catch crocodiles and remove them to, I catch crocodiles that are not where they're supposed to be, and I put them back where they're supposed to be, as well as snakes and whatever. So I said, don't panic about that. I can deal with the crocodiles. And, so few days we mapped out sections of the river, and then we would kayak down the river, myself and my mate, and then hike on the other side of the river. Whenever we saw sort of areas that looked like they might have communities, we would hike, I say inland, but it's all inland, it's not it's a river, it's not the ocean. So we'd hike inland on the other side of the river and try and identify communities. So on the first day we mapped out 15 kilometers of river, and we went down a bit, and we got out. We hiked in 6 kilometers, identified 768 people who hadn't eaten for 11 days, identified the casualties, cut chopper landing zone, took a GPS, worked out what aid was required, and then got back in our kayaks, went downriver, hiked inland again, found a school with 500 people, did the same thing, and we carried on doing that all the way down for the 15 kilometers. And then in the evening, go back to the base camp, and we would report back to the UN and the World Food Program and say, right, this is the GPS coordinates, this is the chopper landing zones that we've cut and the coordinates for that, this is how many people need food, and then the food aid would get dropped by choppers. And the people that needed evacuation would be evacuated. If there was any immediate sort of first aid requirements, we would just do the first aid ourselves, because we both certified first aid. And actually, Wayne, the guy who was with me, is a ambulance tech, because he does VIP close protection. So he's got medical up to ambulance tech. So he's quite a legend. And so I can see you want to ask a question.
I was just going to say, you know, let's talk a little bit about when you had the near-death experiences, if you don't mind, if you're at all. Because I think that will also inspire our readers, listeners, and Rob.
Yeah.
Sure. So on the last day of the Mozambique mission, we were doing a whitewater section of the river, and we had slightly misinterpreted the distancing. We thought we were doing 13 kilometers of river, but it was actually 13 kilometers of road from put in to take out. It turned out that it was actually going to be 26 or 27 kilometers of river. So we thought we were doing 13 kilometers of river. We didn't give enough time for it. We got into a situation where we were running out of light and we were only 11 kilometers in, having run some pretty staunch white water that's never been run before. First descent as far as I know. So there's no intelligence, no beta, no information on the rapids. Plus the river's in flood in a way that it's never been in history because of the cyclone. So even if it had been navigated before, no one's ever run it at that level. We got to a point where we were in a situation where there was three of us, and the third guy decided that he was too exhausted to continue. He couldn't carry on, and there were some fishermen nearby. So we allowed him to get out of the river and make contact with the fishermen and try and find a way to walk out. But myself and another kayaker decided that we would have to bomb as fast down the river as possible to the takeout because there was people waiting for us. And we were worried that they would start a mission, a rescue mission for us, which would be terrible because we don't need that, you know, that we don't need to be causing any more hassles. So I looked at him and I said, all right, we're going to just boat scout, which means you're not going to get out and look at all the rapids like you should, like we had been doing. I think the worst is behind us. Let's just put our heads down, scout from our boats. If anything looks really gnarly, we'll get out and scout it properly, but we're just going to bomb. And so I took the lead and Wayne was behind me. This is a different Wayne, not the same Wayne that I was talking about just now. And we bombed down the river, and it was all going well until I came over a pour over, about a 2 meter drop. It wasn't serious, nothing significant. And as I went over the pour over, I looked, and I just knew that I was in big trouble because at the bottom was just a really retentive, gnarly hydraulic hole. So that's basically creates a back flush that pulls you back in and just dumps you. So as I went over, the current pulled me back in, and it just started thrashing me in my kayak up like over and over. And I managed to hold it a bit and sort of surf on the back wave. And then it thrashed me again and thrashed me again. I fought it for a while, and then I went upside down again. And as I went upside down, at some point during that whole fight, Wayne actually came over the pour over, and while my boat was upside down, he landed on top of mine, and bounced off into safety. So it sort of saved him from getting the same beating by landing on the bottom of my boat. And I was getting thrashed and thrashed and thrashed, and eventually I decided to eject. So I pulled my spray deck and I ejected from the kayak. And normally you flush out, the kayak flushes, fills the water and flushes out, and everything's fine from there. But now you're swimming in dangerous water and trying to get your kayak. But it didn't flush me out. It flushed my kayak out. Wayne was just at the bottom of the rapid watching all of this. And it sucked me back in and dragged me down and just beat me and beat me and beat me and beat me and tried. And I was drowning. I was like legit drowning. And I tried all the tricks. I tried to stretch myself out to catch current. I tried to buoy myself up. I tried to swim down, swim away. I tried to do everything in the book to get out of this situation. Nothing was working. I was just getting sucked back in and drowned. And I got to a point where I was just absolutely weak. Like I could hardly move my arms, my legs, nothing. I was resigned to the fact that it was the end. And I remember thinking to myself, like, right, mate, you've pushed as hard as you can. You've fought as hard as you can. There's nothing you can do now. It's over and I'm okay with this. It's time up. I'm done. I can't fight anymore. And at that point, something happened and I flushed out of the rapid and sort of like floated in a heap towards Wayne sitting in the current, who then just said to me, are you okay? And I was like, hardly being able to talk, hardly half conscious, said, no, but I'll be fine. He said, right, I've got to go and catch a boat. And he threw my paddle at me because he had caught the paddle as it came through. But and then he darted off to go and catch my kayak. So I was, later on, Wayne told me that he estimates sitting there that he watched me getting thrashed for, after ejecting from my kayak, he said I was drowning for at least 3.5 minutes. So fighting full on rapid drowning for 3.5 minutes is quite exhausting. So from there, I was now like lying on a half submerged rock in the middle of this river. The river is about 1 kilometer wide. So I had about 500 meters of river on each side of me. And I could see Wayne downstream chasing my kayak as best as he could. And I just lay there trying to recover and get some energy back. And then I knew that there was only, and then I saw that he hadn't actually managed to catch my kayak, and my kayak had pinned itself on a tree overhanging another rapid much further down the river. I'm guessing about 1.5 kilometers down the river, just judging on the width and the distance. So I guess it was about 1.5 times the width, and the width was about 1 kilometer. So I looked at the situation, and I knew that the only way I'm going to get from being stuck on this rock to my kayak and to the end would be to swim that 1.5 kilometers of river to try and retrieve my kayak and continue from there. But the big issue with that is that, like we mentioned earlier, the river is full of very big and hungry crocodiles that frequently eat people. But luckily for me, the river was in a flood stage, so it was brown flood water. It's like muddy, muddy brown water. So there was no visibility in the water whatsoever. And so I knew that if a crocodile was, you know, crocodiles normally hunt from, they sense the commotion of the water. So if you're splashing and making commotion, they'll sense that, and then they'll submerge and they'll see you underwater and they'll attack. But in a situation where the water's brown like that, they would have to surface hunt. They'd have to come to the top, look at where you are and come along the surface and attack you like that. So I decided that unless, if I kept very, very calm and didn't churn up the water too much, then they probably wouldn't notice me. And if they did come surface hunting me, then I have my paddle. I can at least fight the crocodile and beat it and whatever. I've got another video where I give a crocodile a bit of a hiding with a paddle. And, but yeah, so I was ready to have a fight with a crocodile. And so I swam that very gingerly through, like very slowly, went with the current. And when I had to go through a couple of little rapids. So when I did that, you just go out, turn onto your back, put your feet out, ward off the rocks with your feet. And then when I was about 20 meters from my kayak, I turned onto my back. And as I went through that rapid, I kicked the kayak and grabbed the handle and pulled it through the next rapid with me, and managed to get it onto a rock again in the middle of the river and get up onto the rock. And by that time I saw my buddy was on the bank about 400 meters to the left. And so there was 600 meters of river on the right, 400 meters of river on the left, sitting on this rock above a rapid. So it's river wide rapid in front of me. And I look at the kayak and it's got a massive crack in it. It's broken. So now I was a little bit distraught because I knew the only way to get out of the situation was to swim the path of least resistance that I could find, try and ferry myself across the river and get out, and then we'd have to hike out. I sort of signed to Wayne in river sign language. I said, my kayak's broken. I'm going to swim the path of least resistance and I'm going to get out about 500 meters downstream. And so he was like, yeah, that's great. That's great. And I started to get down into the water to swim, and suddenly he started panicking and like waving his arms, telling me, no, 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 no. And I was like, what? And he made the sign, like big hands clapping like this, which means crocodile. But I looked at him and I said, crocodile? I said, like this, like a swimmer crocodile or like a hippo? And he was like, he did the sign for a hippo, which is just worse news than a crocodile, really, because I can't fight a hippo with a paddle. There's no chance. Mm. And I couldn't see it or anything. There was no way I could see where this hippo was. I tried to see it, but Anyway, so I decided the only plan was to get back into my kayak that was cracked and try and cross-stream ferry the bottom of the rapid and try not to flush into the hippo's pool or wherever he said the hippo was. So those were my options. I could either try and swim the rapid, flush into the thing and die, kayak the rapid, my kayak could fill up and I could flush into the hippo and die, or I could sit on this rock and wait for a crocodile to eat me. So either way, I'm screwed. So I decided to get in the kayak, and I did, and I just put every bit of power and effort I had left in me into paddling across that rapid. And Wayne was waiting in the water about waist deep, and he grabbed my kayak and pulled me over as soon as I got there. So I made it across. And then as I got out, I said to Wayne, "What are you talking about? Where is what?" He's like, "The hippo, mate." And he pointed. And now from that vantage point, I could see the hippo, and it was in the small pool, which I would have had to cross through. And it was absolutely distraught, jumping from one side to the next, angry, upset. I think it had been separated from its pod by the flood and had flushed into that section. So it was really, really unhappy. Then we looked at the situation and we were like, okay, so our only option now is to hike out. We've got 2 hours of sun. We've got about 2 hours. We've got about an hour and a half of sunlight left, and then it's going to be pitch darkness. And the only option was to hike out, and to hike out was through 10 kilometers of extreme Mozambique jungle.
And that was a whole new kind of, what do you want to call it? Whip-ass kind of thing.
Yeah, so the jungle was ridiculous. Thick grass, tall as your ceiling, thorn bushes, it's full of snakes, gaboon vipers, black mambas, all the rest of it. And now we have to make this 10-kilometer trek through this jungle using only a GPS to try and find a road.
In the dark.
Yeah, in the dark.
Cool. And yeah, obviously we want to hear the rest of this story. We're getting sort of shorter time now, so what we're going to do is we'll do it in like two parts, Rob. Is that cool?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And so once this is finished, we can just start another one and...
Yeah, just to finish up.
All right, nice one. Carry on, Paul.
All right, so we looked at the situation, and so for the first 2 kilometers, we dragged our kayaks and it was still light, and we thought we were trying to be really optimistic, but the grass is so tall and the terrain is just so hard that it's really, really slow going. And after that first 2 kilometers, we jettisoned the boats and took a GPS coordinate of where they were for retrieval later. And then the next 8 kilometers were in pitch darkness, where the only thing we had was this little tiny GPS and the arrow on the GPS, and I was navigating. So we'd literally be walking blind and I'd go, okay, a little bit left, okay, a little bit more right, okay, a little bit left, no, too much, more right. And then we'd fall into a thorn tree and fall over ourselves. And so we'd taken the GPS coordinate of the kayaks and jettisoned them. And now all we had left was this navigating with the GPS. And it was hard going. It was a hard 10 kilometers that took much longer than 10 kilometers should take through some gnarly terrain. And we just pushed through it. And after we got to the top of this thing, after falling through many thorn trees, I was scratched up, he was scratched up, we were exhausted, worse for wear, got to the top and got to a road. And then we knew it was now, from that point, 11 kilometers on road to our base camp. So we just turned left and started trudging down the road to see if we could smash that 11 kilometers. And luckily, the search party had been sent out for us, and they picked us up about 30 minutes later after we got on the road, and we managed to get ferried all the way back to the base camp. The unfortunate part was that it wasn't like I got a nice good night's sleep either that night, because my partner Wayne, the other Wayne, we were supposed to leave that day. So he had packed everything into his car to leave. So I ended up sleeping on the floor outside someone else's tent with nothing, without any bedding for the night.
And then left on sleep as well.
And then we left at 4:30 a.m. or 5 a.m. I can't remember exactly, to go back home. So it was a rough night as well.
Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, when you're talking about it before as well, I was thinking, you know, there's so many different areas to that. You know, there's the several different near-death experiences, or, you know, ways where some people wouldn't have survived it, you know, of course. And then it's one thing after another, isn't it? It's challenging. And did you find that, you know, from that experience, you grew a lot more?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have no choice but to grow in that situation. You're going to grow or you're going to die. So I just remember, like, thinking to myself, I've just almost drowned. Then I've almost, like, had a situation where I've had to swim and I could have been eaten by a crocodile at any moment. Then when I thought I was out of the woods and everything was about to be over.
You're in the woods.
The hippo's in my way and that'll definitely kill me.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I get myself out of that situation, I'm now going to trek through 10 kilometers of jungle, not knowing what I'm stepping on or stepping into. And I'm like, someone's playing a joke on me here. What the hell? But by the time I got to the jungle trek, I was annoyingly upbeat, which if you ask Wayne, I think I irritated him for that entire 10 kilometers because he was complaining quite a lot. And I was just being annoyingly upbeat. And I think that was my coping mechanism, was to irritate Wayne with my positive attitude.
Well, and actually, you know, the positive attitude, as Rob and I both talk about, is a wonderful thing to have, and it keeps you going, right? Through different situations sometimes.
Well, that's the thing. Having taught survival courses for 7-8 years, that's one of the things that we always reiterate, is that your morale level is what kills you, not anything else. You keep your head in the game, you just keep pushing, and you keep your morale up, and wherever you can boost your morale, keep doing that, because that's what keeps you alive. Not all the tricks. It's not about the making fire and the hero stunts. It's about your morale at the end of the day.
So did you have to kind of abandon the rescue mission then because of what happened, or did you sort of find some way to carry on with it?
No, it was the last day. And we had seen that there was actually nothing on that section. So it ended up being just a nothing day, you know, because there was no communities attached to that whitewater section for some reason. I think because the river there is quite rough, they can't cross it with the dugouts. It just makes it an area that's not as inhabited as further up the river.
At least it gave you a story to tell, though.
Yeah.
Like some story, yeah. I mean, the thing is that there, as I touched on just now about the elements to it, there's things that a lot of our listeners will enjoy, because it, you know, you can learn so many things from it, you know, to carry on when in the face of adversity you may want to quit or whatever.
As David Goggins says, when you think you can't go on, you've probably only hit 40%.
Interesting.
So, yeah, when you're at that point where you think it can't get any worse, I can't do this any longer, I just can't, you've probably only hit 40% and you've still got 60% actually in you.
Gosh.
Yeah.
And I guess that could apply to many different forms of situations. When you're, you know, I mean, I remember reading about a guy that fell overboard and was in the sea for several hours and he thought he was going to drown. And he said, what would I have done if I'd survived? You know, because he thought, that's it now, no one's going to find me. Mm. And I think, I can't remember the company that he works for, but he started a cider company, and I think it was Stockholm, a Swedish guy. And he became very successful with his brand and his business. But it took him to have a near-death experience, if you will, a life-altering situation, to reevaluate and say, what was I worried about? What was holding me back before? You know, I'm in a situation now, why didn't I just go for it anyway, you know? And it took him that to go and do it, and he did do it, and he did it very well. And you know, it reminds me of that, because obviously there are many different components to certainly what Rob and I go through in business and you know, marketing, with sales, with everything else. And you can easily talk yourself out of things and say, well, maybe I'm not doing enough, you know. Mm. Or maybe I'm not cut out for this, or whatever happens. So I think it's important, isn't it, to understand the mind and how we have to almost direct it more into situations through force sometimes. You were forced to change your situation, and you also work with did you work with Bear Grylls or Four?
Yeah, Four Bear Grylls Survival Academy. So that's the way the survival courses were, the ones I was teaching and all that were for his brand.
Yeah. So that did that allow you to travel around the world and stuff? Did you get all these?
No, ours was based in Victoria Falls. See, the thing with survival stuff is it's very location specific. Like I can probably in Zimbabwe, I can probably handle just about anything and we'll be fine. But coming to the UK, if I was stuck in the middle of the Brecon or something, I'd probably die because I don't know the edible plants there. I mean, I know that I wouldn't die because I you know, I've got 21 days before I have to really worry about food. But it's just to stress the point that different areas require different things and
different knowledge.
Yeah. Is there any transferable skills though? Like, is there some basic principles, like for example, how to find water and shelter, stuff like that?
Yeah, water, shelter, fire is all transferable. Even like hard terrain stuff is transferable. The stuff that's not transferable, which is like if you it's really long term, it's the edible plants and the animal type stuff. So that's where it becomes difficult. So that's why I said I'd probably be fine, but I wouldn't know what to eat and what not to eat in the UK.
Of course, you have got sheep in Wales, so you know, there's a variety of things you can do with those, right?
Including eating them.
So I mean, this has been a fascinating story for me and obviously for our audience, for Robert.
Troops of baboons coming into my yard and trashing my mango tree and going onto my veranda where my bar is and smashing all my glasses for sport and, you know, that kind of nonsense. But in the reality of Zimbabwe, the actual hardships people suffer there every day, 18 hours per day, no electricity. You can have 2 weeks where you open the tap and no water comes out. You have to sit in the queue for 5 days sometimes to get petrol for your car. Exchange rates are changing every 5 seconds. You know, like if that's an exaggeration, but exchange rates are constantly changing. So there's no stability of the money. There's 900% official 900% inflation per annum. There's which is like unheard of for first world countries. There's a situation you can have all the money in the world in the bank and you go to an ATM machine and try and withdraw it. And the ATM just says, oh, sorry, there's no money because there's a massive liquidity crisis in the country. So there's actually no cash available. So trying to run business and operate and live a normal life there is just, everything's hard. So there's no time to relax. Everything, you're always trying to put out some kind of fire or trying to mitigate some kind of problem, or, you know, it's just ridiculous. Then you come here, I mean, and like shortages of basic commodities, you can't get bread, you can't get, you know, things like that. Then you come here, you go to the store, you want to buy bread, and there's 50 different types of bread, not just bread.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing as well, isn't it, is that
you want to buy petrol, there's different kinds of petrol
and it's cheaper than ever now as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's even lower, yeah. And the thing is, you know, obviously, as we all know, we're in this corona thing and it's a bit weird and surreal and all that jazz, and a lot of people are complaining they can't do this, that and the other and go and live their normal lives or whatever, but we're all in the same boat, so to speak. But, you know, I've always been one of these people that I guess I appreciate what I've got. I'm grateful. And I think that for me, that mentality, that attitude has always helped me to never feel like, oh, I'm losing out or I'm, you know, I should have more of this or more of that, you know? So I don't think that happiness is over there or something like that. It's like, you can always be happy if you appreciate the things around you. And, you know, obviously you hear on social media, a lot of people moaning about what's going on. And I think that if you were in a situation that you were in where things are so changeable all the time, and uncertain and unsettling, that must be quite tricky to cope with. And I think, again, that might be a good lesson to our listeners to say, you know, well, we're actually, certainly in England, in a pretty good situation in a way that we can get bread, we can get toilet roll, milk, so on and so forth.
Well, the interesting thing was, like, I mean, there was the massive toilet roll crisis that happened.
Yeah.
Which, it just made me laugh because we come from a place where shortages are real.
Yeah.
So there's no bread because there is no bread. Not because too many people bought bread at once. Because there is no wheat, no bread, no materials, no nothing to make.
Literally no bread.
So when bread comes in, 10 loaves come in and 1,000 people are trying to buy it.
Wow.
And when, so it's that kind of situation. So I'm sitting here laughing while everybody's running to buy toilet paper. And I'm like, this is not a real shortage. This is a shortage created by excessive demand. And all that will do is create people to supply more toilet paper. Yeah. And people will all go and buy the toilet paper. And when they stop buying it because they've got a room full of toilet paper, the shelf will be restocked. And so I didn't buy any extra toilet paper. I didn't hoard anything because I was like, well, they'll just restock the toilet paper because there's no shortage of supply. There's just ridiculous demand right now. Uh-huh. Whereas where we come from, there's an actual shortage of supply, not just the demand.
Uh-huh.
So I just laughed. I was like, you guys don't even know what shortage means.
Well, we really don't. You know, when people say they're worried about a water shortage or something, it's like, hey, my tap isn't going as fast as normal. Maybe it's because I'm in a high-rise building or something. But, you know, people start panicking very quickly here. With any media, of course, any news of...
The media makes it worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think around 2006 or 2007, my parents' house didn't have water for 2.5 years. Oof. And I used to... We had a borehole at our company. And I used to drive a pickup with a big 1,000-liter Bowser towed behind. Every day I'd go to work from our private borehole. I'd pump 1,000 liters of water into the Bowser and then drag it home at the end of my working day and fill up tanks around my at my parents' house to support them with the, because they had 2.5 years of no water.
Wow, that's quite something, isn't it?
And
it's a bit like the hierarchy of needs thing, isn't it? You know, you look at the triangle and you think, there's the basic things. And if you haven't got the basic things, you're buggered, you know?
Well, that's it. But I was also privileged because I had a car and a Bowser and a company and all the rest of it. The general population of the 98% unemployed of Zimbabwe living in on less than $1 a day, you know, are not towing home any Bowsers. Those guys are walking 10 kilometers to carry a 20-liter thing of water from a borehole if they can. Otherwise, the ones who are in the cities just go without.
That's 98%, you said?
I think the statistic at some point was 98% unemployment, but I don't know if that's an official statistic because most of the official statistics are doctored in Zimbabwe to make them look better than they are.
Sounds like the government, huh? Here, I mean. So, you know, obviously it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Paul, and I'm sure that there are many, many more stories that you could share with us. And you have got, obviously I've been checking your stuff out, your videos, your content, some wonderful stories, and I've seen your dance moves. They're way better than mine, so I'm pretty well gelled there. So I need to sort of brush up on that. Where can people find you if they want to know more about you or, you know, connect with you? Or
so Facebook and Instagram is at Raw Teasdale. That's at RAWTEASDALE. That'll take you to my Facebook page and to my Instagram feed. And otherwise, it's www.paul-teasdale.com. And that's where I write short stories about these adventures and these crazy things that happen. And get in touch. I'm happy to chat to anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess you're always sort of uploading new stuff, are you? Or, I mean, obviously the videos are based a lot around where you were before, right?
I create content here a little bit as well, but at the moment I've got years and years of backlog of photos and videos and stories and topics that I'm trying to get through as well. So... most of it goes into my Instagram and Facebook, but then the actual written stories and the more depth stuff goes onto my website.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I've been sort of reading a lot of it. It's very well put together. I love it. And with your content, obviously, you've got more that you're going to be uploading to these sites from beforehand, so people can get access to those things and see them as you upload them and talk about them, learn more about your life and what you were doing there. And some of the adventures and crazy stuff that, well, you've told me about, and I thought, No, thanks. I'll stay here. So, yeah, I think we'll sort of wrap it up there, Rob. Would that be okay for you?
Yeah, definitely. I've got to shoot off anyway. But, yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure to hear all your stories. And, we'll have to come on for a part two.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get you
on. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
So, obviously, with Rob and me, our details, you can share those later, Rob, on...
Everything will be in the description below the podcast, wherever you're listening to it.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, guys, for coming on the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure, Paul. Thanks for sharing your precious time with us. I'm Greg, and you can find me by Googling Greg Detisi, D-E-T-I-S-I, on Google and social media stuff. And Rob?
Everything will be linked below. So just check the description of the podcast.
Yeah. Awesome. And we'll see you soon again, guys, for the next episode.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Cheers.